And what happened is that they actually, at the time, lowered the barrier to guilds. So all of a sudden, people that were active in one field were able to apply their knowledge and their whole background into other fields. And that's how you kind of got to the Leonardo da Vinci moments of that period. So I think that was one socioeconomic kind of driver for what happened in the Renaissance.
I'm Joe Lonsdale. Welcome to the American Optimist. I'm really excited to have my good friend, we can call you Dr. Jeanette Furstenberg. You're also Princess Jeanette Furstenberg. Jeanette, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jeanette, let's tell people a little bit about you. You have a PhD in philosophy and entrepreneurship from the Free University of Berlin. You've had extremely successful first venture capital funds. You're a venture capitalist. Talk a little bit about your PhD. I'm fascinated. You studied how entrepreneurship and art, you know, impacted each other throughout the ages. What eras did you focus on for that?
Yeah, no, it's actually a fascinating topic. So I had the luck of having a grandfather that was really one of the most inspiring people I've come across, because he was an artist before becoming an entrepreneur. And then he basically took a lot of that creative destruction mindset and applied it to entrepreneurship. And he had no idea of engineering, had no idea of physics. And he built a business that was really deeply rooted in the process industry. So very, very kind of deep techie. And it, like, you know, required from the outside, and it required very different skill sets to what he actually
brought
to the table.
Deep tech, but he started as an artist.
He started as an artist, and then he took that company over from his uncle who died in the war. And his grandmother was like, hey, can you take care of it for a couple of months until we find a replacement? And it was like a 10 people company at the time. And then he basically took it over and then actually built that into a global business. And but he always retained that exposure and that interest in art. He, like, you know, he always collected art. He would always host artists at our place. And I kind of grew up in this mindset and this, like, kind of...
You saw art and entrepreneurship as being really related.
No, not initially. I think that kind of revelation came later. But I saw him kind of very much intertwining art, literature. He was a, you know, very passionate reader. He was a very passionate reciter of poems. He was someone that would always be extremely curious in very, very many different domains. And that curiosity has kind of led him to pull in, you know, people that would sit around our dinner table that really had seemingly nothing to do with one another, but really were kind of been creating very interesting discussions that were just kind of sparking new ideas. And that is kind of a great analogy to the way he ran his business. So he would always kind of, as one example, if he was confronted with an issue or with a problem, which was in his specific case, a level and flow meter process, and it's called the Coriolis effect, which basically measures the flow that flows through a U-shaped cube. And that flow is basically being measured, or at the time was measured, by kind of measuring the vibration and lots of different variables from a sensor perspective.
Why did this matter, the flow through a U-shaped cube?
And the problem he was facing, that his engineers were facing, is that the flow would actually create other kind of substances, would create residence, and they weren't really scalable to large diameters. So if you think about the oil and gas industry, which kind of evolved in the time when I was a child, they were like, listen, we have to make it like a straight tube. It doesn't work to have a U-shaped form. And that straight tube was something that all engineers told him was impossible. It's like, you know, we cannot build a straight tube. You know, it has to be the U-shaped form. That's the only way the process works. So he said, listen, take a look at this violin string and the way it's swinging. Let's try to replicate that effect. So he basically always applied concepts that weren't really innate to the industry, and basically through that disrupted and hacked a lot of new sort of innovations into the business. And that is just something that always fascinated me. And then when I went and studied initially philosophy and business, I thought this has really very little to do with what I've learned with my grandfather. You know, you learn about accounting and you learn about all these different, you know, marketing strategies, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, it all sounds great and well, but it has nothing to do with this kind of spirited, kind of really creative, disruptive force that I was observing.
So the energy of the entrepreneur and the genius philosophy of the entrepreneur is not at all what they teach in business school. They kind of teach the boring parts.
Yeah, exactly. It's the super boring parts, which really, in the end of the day, you just figure it out, right? It's just kind of common sense to some degree. So what I then, I was really dissatisfied with that. And then I was actually, I came across this professor in Berlin, and he was teaching entrepreneurship, and his whole thought was kind of going to that direction. And I said, hey, I'd really love to explore if art and entrepreneurship have something to do with one another, if there is an intersection and what that actually means for companies to succeed. And if there's a structural, you know, sort of, you know, root cause to it and where that can be traced back to. And that's how we actually looked at the Renaissance, which is an amazing sort of exercise, because you really look at a period in time where, you know, Europe was really very much in the Middle Ages. It was very much kind of lost in darkness to some degree. Mm. And then you had these very little ecosystems in, you know, Florence and in Siena, that all of a sudden were propelling themselves 200 years ahead of their time. So I really wanted to understand, why was that? Like, you had, on the one hand, very successful, you know, banking families such as the Medicis and such as several others. And then you had this emergence of incredible art, right? Like, you had really like the Renaissance, which is like looking at Botticelli, looking at Donatello, looking at the beautiful.
It is interesting. The Renaissance in culture was a rebirth of art and literature. At the same time, you had some new entrepreneurship coming
up. Yeah, you had actually, and that's the interesting part, I'm going to get to that later, you actually had the birth of entrepreneurship, as Max Weber said. So Max Weber said, like, entrepreneurship was really kind of born in that time. So the way, or what I actually found out is that, looking at this period, you initially had a very strong segregation between different crafts, right? We had the craft of wood manufacturing, you had the craft of, I don't know, painting, you had the craft of, you know, the stonemasons. So all of these were very, very separate fields.
You'd be a guild, you work for years.
Exactly. And these guilds were kind of very, very kind of passed on from father to son. And they were very much kind of, you know, like isolated, if you like. And what happened is that they actually, at the time, lowered the barrier to guilds. So all of a sudden, people that were active in one field were able to apply their knowledge and their whole background into other fields. And that's how you kind of got to the Leonardo da Vinci moments of that period. So I think that was one socioeconomic kind of driver for what happened in the Renaissance. And then what happened is that you had a lot of you know, merchants at the time that were traveling all the way to the Middle East, and they were kind of buying silk, et cetera, in order to kind of drive that type of that type of business.
So was this bringing other cultures and mixing? Is that tied to it as well?
No, so it was more the question of, like, they were building a business, right? Which is basically you had some money. You went to the Middle East, it took you a long, long time, a long trip, you came back, you sold that, you had just enough money to kind of, you know, make your family stay alive, and then you would basically take the leftovers and reinvest it. So it's basically no working capital provision of any sort. Mm-hmm. And what happened is that at the same time you had an invention, which was a double-sided bookkeeping, basically. Mm-hmm. And something called the bill of exchange. And these were inventions that happened kind of separately at the time. And these weren't really, I call them inventions, because they only became innovations when people actually combined the two. So you had people like the Medici that were seeing all of their, you know, themselves being merchants. They saw other merchants always struggling from the fact that they couldn't take credit. Credit was actually forbidden at the time, right? It was only Jews that were kind of able to hand out credit, and even that not happening in a legal facility. So the Medici looked at it and said, "Hey, wait a minute! Like, we need to travel there. Like, why don't we use the bill of exchange as a way for credit, as a means for credit?" So they basically combined an invention that already existed, and basically took that as a means to accelerate the economy and really create what was the banking sector at the time. And the interesting, I think learning you can draw from that is that they did something that most entrepreneurs do. They look at a given problem, right? And then they just often take things that are already existing and they just kind of reshuffle them to something new, right? They recreate them in a way and shape or form that you might not have known before, right? And there's always a stark difference between just, you know, science versus the actual applied science, which then becomes innovation in business.
As an entrepreneur, I'm curious. So the Medici's, what you described is a process innovation, which anyone can use, but they must have done it in a way that specifically helped their own banking empire.
Yeah.
And was it because everyone trusted their bill of exchange or how is it specifically
applied
to them?
They were the first ones to see that. And that's actually the interesting part. So because you had people that were kind of getting richer and richer, so you had merchants that were becoming rich. At the same time, these merchants, and that's actually the whole art side of things, but I was just talking about the economic part of it, but looking at the art side of the whole Renaissance evolution is that you had people that became wealthy, and in order to show their wealth, they would hire and patronize artists to kind of, you know, make them beautiful palaces and like make
all
of that
very elaborate.
This would
be a status symbol.
As a status symbol initially, right. But that type of status symbol led to a very high degree of competition on talent. So you had all the artists, you know, coming from the Netherlands and Germany, and they would all, in different parts of Italy, they would all travel there because they knew there was business to be made, and they knew that there was a way for them to succeed
and
make a name for themselves.
And the competition drove it to higher heights, of course.
And the competition kind of drove it to higher heights. And that just kind of accelerated from like the, you know, from the origins of painting at the time all the way to mannerism. And these was like very, very fast progressions that you were seeing in art at the time. And I'm not an art historian, but what I thought was really interesting is that you had these two overlapping trends, and you had the Medici as an actor that was really in between both fields. They were always very passionate about art. They, in their patronage, in their patronship of art, they were the ones that actually took risk as well, right? They commissioned Brunelleschi to build the chapel of Florence, which at the time was the largest sort of freestanding cupola that existed in the world. So them being, you know, a very prominent economic figure, them being a very prominent political figure as well, they kind of put a lot of trust in that artist and in that architect to really make that happen. Because if that cupola would have crashed, it would have had a very, very severe impact on their perception as leaders, on their perception as entrepreneurs, and their perception of many different fields. But they always took these risks. They're always really engaged in the actual art process themselves. There are like a lot of letters between them going back and forth with artists on like how a given artwork should look like, what the different dimensionalities
could be. That's interesting. The artists don't like that today if someone tries
exactly,
to
but that was,
too involved.
And that's an interesting part, because at the time art wasn't really considered an artist wasn't considered a genius. This whole development of like the artist as a genius came much later. It actually came at the end of the Renaissance, but initially they were just contractors. They were like basically hired by a patron. The patron was the one driving.
And so you know, in our technology companies today, I always focus on, of course, the engineering culture, but also the design culture, something we consider to be really important, which I know you agree with. Maybe just stay on the Renaissance, just briefly, like how did the art culture impact their entrepreneurship in return? Because it seems like they've made all this money, they made all this art awesome, but how did it make them into better entrepreneurs?
Yeah. So I think like it cannot be said for certain. I think my view on that is by being so close to the creative process in art, you're constantly dealing with people essentially that are seismographic for societal change. They're very like more ephemeral than, you know, people like you and I would interact with in the business world are. And they're very kind of sensitive to structural societal
changes.
They're
making more connections between different areas.
Exactly. And they're more, exactly. They're like, they're operating at a wavelength and abstraction level that is similar to what you may know from math, or that exists in other fields of creation.
This is a really good energy for an entrepreneur to be exposed to like more metacognition, more thinking broadly and creatively, and it inspires them.
Yeah, exactly. I think my view is that this really allows you to think in a disruptive way and to innovate and go away from sort of incremental innovation to disruptive innovation and really create something that's essentially new rather than just better
So you've been a very successful venture investor. You're scaling your firm. How are you applying this today? Are there examples of how this works today?
Yeah, I think there are many examples. And I think looking at the best founding teams, you usually have a mix of both, right? Like if you look at philosophy, you would probably have something called the realist, and you would have someone called an idealist, right? They usually, like if you look at the best founding teams, they're usually kind of very very complementary in that sense. Speaking of the two cultures you also just mentioned, so you have some people that are more deterministic, you know, they're more sort of rational, top down, you know, they just kind of apply a more rigorous sort of technology perspective. And then you have others that are more idealistic, so they're more in this kind of creative sort of bottom up, like what could this be, like what is the relative distortion
field? You try to pair these people together in these companies?
Well, I'm not pairing them. They usually find themselves, right? That's the interesting part. Like you always would find like similar patterns in founders, in my view. And what I find fascinating is looking at the best founders, they really have almost like a reality distortion field thereafter, right? They basically see 10 to 15 years in the future, and they, similar to an artist really, like similar to any creator, and then they have the ability to break that down into like smaller bite-sized kind of like periods or like milestones basically that are graspable for future employees, that are graspable for investors. But they essentially also have to be very good at storytelling. They're basically drawing you a picture of what that could be. And that's actually a concept that happened that existed in the Renaissance called disegno. Disegno is basically a term that was used for drawing, so basically the initial drawing you would make like a sketch, but it also was used as a means to express how ideas actually materialize from your head into something that is graspable, right? That is tangible for others.
So you have something, an idea in your head that's very high level, and you have to somehow turn it into something someone else can understand.
Yeah, someone else can understand. Somebody else can follow you on. Right.
So the idea is real and it's cool, but it's just in your head in some kind of other format.
Yeah, and people have to people have to be able to follow you. So for example, had Zuckerberg or Larry Page, had these guys gone out initially and said, you know, we are going to create data as a currency, and this is actually what Google is going to become 20 years from now, people would have called them crazy, right? So what they did is they just built like initially a search engine, they initially built a social network, right? That people, I think, cannot follow you the whole way through. You can't give
them the thing from 20 years ahead. Even if you're thinking that way, you've got to give them the thing.
Exactly. You have to break it down for others to be able to follow you.
Interesting. Yeah, I think it's always the hardest part when we create startups is how we basically create the path, then the path becomes a part of the real world.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
And they create, you create a path also into an unknown future. I think that's the interesting part, right? You're basically creating the future, you're crafting it. Yeah. That's what I find so exciting about entrepreneurship, is that we are really the ones building it. And that you have to follow the best and brightest founders to achieve that. And
it's sometimes described to me as building the bridge without knowing exactly where the other side is yet, which is very scary for some people.
Yeah. But the whole fear, I think fear has to be something that's built into the concept. You have to be able to be comfortable operating under fear.
Is it a dialectic between like the engineers and the technologists and this the creative energy? Because you need both, but it's not just a dialectic, because they're actually part of the same thing, but there also are like different forces in the company as well.
Yeah.
So do you have to have some people in the company that are, they're usually more artistic and visionary, and some that are more technical working together,
I think the best example for that would be, you know, the whole technology and product side, right? One has to be more like looking at product these days and the consumerization of enterprise as one example. You want to have very intuitive interfaces, which has to do a lot with empathy. You have to kind of understand your user. You have to understand what their fears are, like what their inhibitions are in using your product. You know, look at low code as sort of the most extreme example, right? And we have one company that basically builds a data infrastructure product, but they basically have an interface that allows for SQL and low code to run in parallel. So
SQL,
you basically have two user groups.
SQL is a complicated database language that you have to be technologists to use, and the low code is anyone could figure it
out. And I think that's a great example where you kind of try to marry the two, but you need people on the product side that really have the empathy for the user to understand, like, where is it that someone that is not a technologist and not a data scientist is able to follow me here? And what is the dimension that is actually deep enough for a technologist to kind of take seriously, right? So I think that's probably the best example for that question.
Let's step back and talk a little bit about your fund. It's called La Familia. And what's the mission? You're trying to connect established industry with startup ecosystem. And this is kind of fun because your family background, obviously you're from a more established industry, but then you're also working in the startup ecosystem. You're trying to help others do that. Talk to us a little bit about the mission.
So I think what I observed around sort of 6 years ago is that Europe was undergoing a very interesting transformation, right? You had all these world market leaders across several fields, you know, people, some companies you've never heard of, but they became specialists in what essentially powers B2B infrastructure across logistics, across supply chain, across manufacturing. So what the thesis was that technology would really be a horizontal enabler to productize that into digital value and see how, you know, that could really transform into something that is sort of 21st century ready. And the interesting aspect for Europe versus the US is that in order to take a company to market, I think you're much more reliant on buy-in from these large companies. Like if you want to sell a product into a Daimler, into BMW, it's sometimes can take you 2 years to kind of really get to kind of some degree of workable sales motion. And the thesis was that if we were really kind of keen on making Europe succeed at this sort of core value proposition, which I think is something that is amazing and something that Europe is really able to excel at versus consumer, where we were just not as strong because our market is so much more heterogeneous, then we would be able to really build a very strong foundational technology ecosystem there.
And this is a hard thing to do, obviously. I remember going to Europe 10 or 15 years ago with companies that I was working on, and the big companies were not too interested in working and engaging with startups. And I guess that's maybe changed in the culture a little bit. You've helped change it too.
In all humility, I think I try to play my part. I was at least very engaged in making that change, being part of that change, because I think it's so important. And what we did with La Familia is that we just brought together the brightest entrepreneurs as investors. So these are people that have built and scaled large businesses in Europe. together with some founders, you know, that already had first initial successes in the consumer internet world at the time. And then we started investing into B2B companies at the early stages. You know, these were like companies in SMB or anything relating to horizontal workflow automation and enterprise. So we had really like built a broad portfolio have built a large portfolio.
And how'd you bring these people together? I mean, I think we all have to use our unfair advantages. One unfair advantage you have is that you're a princess and you have like really cool castles and stuff. Is that an advantage to bring people together because they want to come hang out and be at these places?
I think, you know, what is interesting, if you look at Europe and if you think of the way Europe has evolved, we always had something called the parlor culture or the salon culture, right? Which is essentially something where you would host curious minds and discuss, you know, literature, play music, discuss poetry, where people would recite. And like,
this is what Americans think of Paris when we hear about it.
Exactly. So Paris at the turn of the century, Vienna at the turn of the century. And, if you think that a lot of that was really driven by Jewish intellectuals, which unfortunately all had to flee, or large parts of them had to leave Europe. But it kind of still led us to kind of have a culture where you would basically bring people in and kind of have them unite and be curious about one another. But the issue, on the other hand, that Europe is facing, and that is very different towards the US, is that Europe is very, I wouldn't say suspicious of new things, but they are very cautious, right? And that's kind of just a consequence of, if you have everything to lose, then you're obviously much more cautious. And if you have everything to gain, right?
It's so, kind of funny. We always see the old world as more intellectually cautious, whereas there's like more cowboys here on the frontier pushing things ahead. But I mean, things are being pushed ahead pretty fast now around Europe too, but it just took longer.
It took longer, but I think like we've reached an inflection point. But let me just maybe quickly stay on the evolution a little bit. So what I think is interesting in the European ecosystem is that you all of a sudden see this very strong cohesion of companies that are either disrupting or enabling these large companies, and them really kind of, you know, building rapport and building early connections to founders and entrepreneurs from established industry. And I think the way to make that happen is to really, by allowing them to by basically creating a trusted access platform, right? And that's what La Familia does. Like, that's what I care about doing, is by bringing people and entrepreneurs together face to face. Because once you do that, they always speak the same language. All of them want their businesses to succeed ultimately. But it usually happens at the second or third management level, mm-hmm. where that type of exchange just stalled.
Well, your role is a trusted intermediary, where if you're working with the entrepreneur, they know this is serious. Yeah. They know there's a good chance that technology's been checked. It's going to work. These people aren't crazy.
Exactly. So I think that's in part what we're doing, is that we kind of invite entrepreneurs that I've grown up with, you know, like the whole German Mittelstand, where I come from, is very connected. Like you grow up with a lot of next gens from other companies and other, you know, firms that were similar to yours. So I had already built that network, which then got enhanced over time. And that is something that I think is very valuable in creating this like very deep trust and bringing them basically together in an informal environment that is not transactional. I think the US works very well on a transactional front, because it's less considered a fallacy, or not less considered a, you know, something odd to just walk up to someone and discuss something new, right? In Europe, you would be, maybe except for Italy, people would look at you odd if you just walk up to someone and say, hey, like, what are you doing? Shall we discuss a business opportunity here? It's just nothing that I think
you kind of need a bigger middleware to connect it and make it normal in Europe, and make it healthy, make it trusted. So given you have these networks, but obviously you're identifying new talent as well. How do you identify new talent? How do you diligence people? How do you find the top up and coming entrepreneurs?
Yeah. So I think similar to everyone, I think a lot of it is just network driven. So we have all sorts of, you know, we obviously have the whole screening and the technology driven deal flow sourcing, et cetera, but then it comes down to actually seeing everything. And then after seeing everything, it's like, what are the right filter mechanisms, right? And I think that's where...
Are some of those just intuitive as well? You have to have an eye for people?
I think so. And I think that eye for people is actually key, right? In especially in seed and early stage, is often all there is. Like, you may have early innings of a product, you may have early innings of, you know, first customer signaling, but usually you have to be very, very confident just backing strong talent. And I think that's something that, looking at, you know, literature, for example, you learn so much about human intent, as one example. Like, you learn or you read a lot about what is it that innately really drives people, that really, how does intent surface? How does it manifest? What are just early innings of talent? So I think because I've always been really passionate about literature, really passionate reader of many different pieces, maybe that's kind of the lens
one way my put it is you have a larger ontology of human nature that you're then building intuition around. So you can see people and see where they fit into different types of that. And so people who study literature, people who study philosophy, maybe they have more ways to think about people and more ways to analyze the parts that are really hard.
Yeah, I think, you know, our industry is great, Joe, because there are just so many different lenses that are, you know, applied to like screening talent. Like you may spot something very different to what I may find interesting. And I think it just happens so because we all have, you know, different levels of abstraction. I think what I'm always passionate about is dealing with people. Like smart people always have a high level of abstraction and very multi different, you know, dimensions, right? And then once you create a cohesive layer there, that's when you get pattern recognition on talent, on intuition.
I have found that a lot of the most useful models that I have, which are very hard to put into words, come from having worked with Alex Karp, who also had a PhD in philosophy from Germany. So I think there is maybe something about German philosophy that gives you a richer, and you know, maybe probably literature as well, that gives you a richer perspective on this. So it does, maybe that kind of ties back a little bit to what you were talking about before with the artists and the entrepreneurs, where if you have these like different pieces of experience in human nature, you can kind of bring it together and understand it better.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Philosophy is just a similar abstraction to math or to other areas. You will have a genius math brain. I have less of a genius math brain. I'm more like my language is really that, right? Like you have these conceptual frameworks that you can apply and that kind of give you guidance and give you some degree of, you know, intuitive action, but then also allows you to actually just get to complexity faster.
Ability, if you had applied this in Europe 20 years ago, my bias is it would have been a lot harder because something's obviously changed. Like, yeah. The companies are more open to it. It seems like human talent. Yeah, if you would have asked like, where is the top next Google coming from 20 years ago, obviously 30 years ago, it was from the Bay Area, from Silicon Valley. And now there's all these bright minds in Europe that are building these things. Like why has human talent shifted that way in Europe? What's going on that's allowed all these people to express themselves this way?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I think first of all, we always had strong engineering talent, right? That's just a given. And that's not only in the center of Europe, but also in Eastern Europe. So I think we've had a very, very strong initial engineering talent base. I think what has shifted very much is failure culture. So I think that's something we've really very much learned from you guys, and like by looking at, you know, the Silicon Valley more as a guiding North Star.
People are willing to go outside the bounds as well.
Go outside the bounds, lose, or like kind of a little bit get rid of that fear of failure. Because it used to be that, especially in Germany or more traditional sectors, if you failed at something, you were burned. Like you could go home and like put ashes on your head and kind of, you know, just stay out of it, right?
Yeah.
And that just created this initial fear and inhibition to really go and create and build. And I think that is something that has very much changed over the last few years. And it's just become where people used to go into banking or consulting before, they're now all kind of looking to work in technology.
And have you backed people who have had a big failure and then they had a big success afterwards? Is that happened
yet?
Yes.
And that's happening more and more, right? And it's also happening because a lot of these people have seen scale, right? I think that we're getting to this point in the ecosystem where we have seen, you know, large companies that, you know, came to like multi-billion dollar outcomes in Europe. And then all of a sudden you have companies that come off of that from like a second generation, like the product manager of a neobank that now goes and builds like, you know, an accounting business in the SMB space. So you have like all of these new founders that are kind of second generation, kind of productizing problems or productizing value that they have seen elsewhere. And also they have then come already with the idea of scale. They've seen scale, they've experienced scale in terms of culture. And initially that was so much harder to transmit from the US to Europe. I remember the first successful companies here, they constantly went to the US and tried to get best practices on how to scale HR, like how to hire, like what is the appropriate sort of salary framework.
Well, everyone disagrees on that here anyway, though.
Excuse me?
Everyone disagrees about the answers.
Yeah, but
you can get a sense of what's going on.
Yeah.
One of the mottos of La Familia is that you say that we believe that contrarian investments will outperform conformist investments.
Yeah.
What's contrarian and what's conformist? How does that work?
I think it's a great question. So conformist usually is what people would sort of expect, or what the actual.
So if the average person is very comfortable with this as an investment, maybe it's not as good as the one that they're uncomfortable with.
Exactly. So, and the uncomfort really comes, it's usually associated to risk, right? It's usually associated to something that is almost pie in the sky type.
Yeah, like the Airbnb when you hear about it early, that sounds very uncomfortable.
So looking at, for example, our company.
You probably don't Airbnb the castle.
Exactly. Not yet, no. But looking at, for example, our company Stoke, you know, which is like a space launcher company, or our company Unai, which is basically like building VR headsets, right? People look at that industry and say like, oh, you know, hardware, and like it's so hard and stuff. And yes, it is tough, and yes, it is hard. But these guys are just like listening to these founders, and that's what I mean by being contrarian, like, and by following the vision and being able to kind of buy into the reality distortion field of certain talent, is they are just so good. Right.
This person's
just
a genius, so incredibly they see something
amazing. Yeah. And then the question becomes like, great, in my view, great founders never fail. They may not succeed, but they never fail. I think that's a very fine but meaningful difference, right? And I think you have to be comfortable with gaining control along the way as a founder and also as an investor. Like, you cannot have control at the beginning. You cannot know everything at the beginning. You have to kind of be comfortable in buying into some macro, right? It's like, do we believe the macro market for that is going to be there, even though it may not manifest in real market size today? So these are all, I think, questions or answers tied to what we believe makes good contrarian bets.
I want to make sure, Janelle, I get to ask you about some of the way US is approaching these things. A lot of US institutions, they're maybe not as focused on contrarian and genius stuff. They're really focused on making sure they're backing diversity, and they're really focused on kind of creating categories to make sure underrepresented people get involved, which yeah. And I know you and I both think it's a good thing to do that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it could be kind of annoying how they approach diversity. I'm curious to hear, like do you ever feel like is it ridiculous sometimes what goes on in the US around this, or is it similar as in Europe, and what's happening there?
You know, I cannot speak to the US versus Europe as much, because I'm not aware. I mean, we discussed this a little bit, but I'm not aware of a lot of the things that are going on here. I think just in general on the subject of diversity, I grew up, you know, it like was born in the 80s, you know, and then I kind of just grew up in a mindset thinking that, you know, everything wasn't fully solved, but I had all the chances I wanted. If I wanted to, I had a family that was able to support me in going through like good educational programs, etc. But in the end, the world was mine to conquer. That's kind of the belief that I always had.
You didn't feel like there was a gender bias against you, or maybe a little bit in some ways?
A little bit. And I think, you know, my grandfather, who loved me dearly and who thought the world of me, he looked at me and said, you cannot have children and also, you know, run a company. How should that work? And now here we are, like I have four kids, right? And I think it is
working. Four young children, and you're building something big. That was very hard to do 40 years
ago. Yeah, so he kind of confronted me with that very strong bias. But I think the question with bias always is, you have to be able to, you know, put that into context, first of all, right? Understand where he's coming from. He's born in a very different generation. And then secondly, not assume malice in people confronting you with biases, right? Like, especially as a woman, like I have seen a lot more goodwill and support, especially from men in that industry, such as yourselves. You know, you have been incredibly supportive of me since the very beginning. Like when I came and started La Familia, a lot of people in Europe probably had more question marks around what I was doing than you had.
A lot of people are very cynical when people start things.
Yeah, especially in Europe, the venture had never worked. You know, venture in Europe, like, where are the returns? Oh my God, there are no exits. Like, I got all these questions. And then obviously, like, what do you have to do in this whole situation? Like, it just seemed very counterintuitive to people in Europe. Yeah. But you and people like Ilad, who's a mutual friend, or Daniel, like, these were all people that when I met them, they kind of trusted me. They said, hey, this is cool, just do it. You know, there was not even a question on whether I would be capable of doing it, whatever. They just thought it was a great idea, and we should just give it a try. You know, that's the kind of spirit I kept getting. And back to the point of men, especially from men, because there aren't, like, if you're looking for mentors in that industry, there are very few women that have succeeded in business, in traditional industries, but also in the startup ecosystem specifically. So you have to kind of lean on to men to support you and to guide you and to give you their shared experience.
One of the things that bothers me a little bit, I have very talented female partners, and they're partners because they're talented, obviously, not because they're female. And I see you in that list as a good friend who's extremely talented at what you do, regardless of gender.
Yeah.
A lot of these conferences, it feels like they're only showing you off because you're a woman, not because you're the best. I'm curious what your experience is with
that. And I think that's terrible. I think it's not helping diversity. It's really not helping us as women, I believe, if we're being put into like a separate corner where we're being like, you know, looked at as pets almost, you know, it's like, oh, look, how cute, you know, it's a woman. Like, you want to succeed just in the same way. I'm in a business, is in the end, we're all here to make money. And I have to deliver returns to my investors. And that's what I'm here to do. And I'm not here to be like, you know, looked at as sort of some cute little, you know, or like something that needs to be protected, like a rare animal, you know, that deserves like a special place in the zoo.
Should there be special panels for women?
No, I don't think so. I think there should be panels that discuss content and not the whole diversity question per se.
My father's a chess coach, where he's the top kids chess coach we talked about. And he won the state almost every year with his public elementary school here in the US. And they started having these different tournaments for women for chess.
Yeah.
And my dad and I thought this was kind of obnoxious because it's like women should be able to compete directly with men.
And there's so many examples of that, right?
And then when we criticized it, we got criticized and they said, oh no, you have to have separate divisions for women for that, which seems very strange to me. So why are people doing that?
You know what? I think it's just, this is where politics can just get in the way of things, in my view. And that's where politics really doesn't help at all. I think to some degree, yes, there was like a female quota that maybe has been helpful, especially in the corporate structures, in order to kind of enforce that.
And I'm because you shift the culture a bit.
Because you shift the culture, you force them. Like in Europe, in Germany especially, they adopted like a 40% quota for board members to be female, and then they're doing the same thing on like a senior leadership in companies. And I think it's possibly a great way to pull more female talent.
Doesn't it mean that people are skeptical of the female woman on the board, though?
Of course. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's a downside. I cannot have the opinion to the same degree that people have that have worked in corporate cultures. I have never been exposed to that environment, but I can speak to the technology industry and the technology ecosystem. And I've been confronted with biases from investors who didn't think a woman was able and capable of managing money. But I never took it personal, and I never took it as something that, you know, I wanted to cancel or I wanted to, you know, throw off. I said, you know, these guys will maybe learn later. It's fine. You know, like there are other people that trust me, and that's the important thing. Yeah. In like investing founders, but also in yourself and in diversity as a whole. I think trust creates magic, right? If you trust people and if you show them trust, it empowers and unleashes like a full load of potential. And then, you know, if I trust founders, I have investors that trust me. Eventually, you know, sometimes things go wrong. Sometimes you get disappointed. And the small tax that you kind of end up paying for the trust that you give. But I think the upside you get from trust in all directions and dimensions.
That's the business. You have to keep giving it out in the right way.
Yeah, you have to keep giving that. And you have to make sure you give that. It's just a cultural thing. Like, I give that towards my employees. I give that towards my founders. Investors give it towards me. And I think that's the way we really make sure we can overcome the bias. And I think just one more thing. On the diversity front, one thing that actually saddens me is the fact is this whole sort of woke cancel culture movement currently, simply because I feel like it has a sense of leeching the trust out of society. You know,
it makes people have to be too careful with each other.
Too careful. Trust. It makes people, it just kind of assumes bad intent. Like, that's what you're essentially doing. And how can we operate as a society? How can I take the bus? How can I get on a train if I have to assume there are people that, you know, have just malicious and bad intent? Like, it doesn't work. That's what I feel.
It makes men have to be more careful too than they should.
Yes, imagine how sad it would be if I wasn't able to get into a meeting room with a man and like with a person such as you to discuss and learn from you. I think that would be a shame. And I've always grown up with, you know, people that were very different. I was always curious about people that were just essentially, I don't know, very different. And then they may have ended up being homosexual, or they may have ended up being like in any kind of the, like, let's say, how do you call that, marginalized part of society front, simply because they're usually very curious and interesting people in the, you know, active in the art field, etc. But what I'm saying is that if I, in these interactions now, have to apply filter after filter after filter in the way that I interact with them, and I'm not able to...
It's not helpful to everyone.
I have tons of my friends pulled blonde jokes on me. If I was now going to start like saying, oh my God, like, how can you condemn me for being a blonde? You know, I'm going to cancel you. That's ridiculous. Like, then these people are just not going to be as real and as willing to interact with me anymore. And I think that's where real bias happens. Yeah. That's actually where this whole thing just goes wrong.
It's more important we have more trust in society and less ability to take each other down.
Yeah. And I think that's also where democracy, and I think that's maybe an important point to mention as well, where democracy happens. Like, there's a German philosopher, speaking of it, Habermas, who actually your friend Alex Karp also studied. And he said that democracy is essentially something that happens in conversation, you know? Like, it doesn't happen in, you know, in the, let's say, pure political sphere, but it happens in you and I discussing and sharing arguments, right? And discussing different perspectives we share. And I think it's so important that we make sure that room doesn't shut down. Like, we must be able to, you and I discuss a lot. I think you have incredibly strong arguments. I may come to different conclusions at times, and that is fine. Like, I can have a different conclusion to you. And that is also rooted in the fact that, yes, we all seek truth as humans, but the way we come to truth or we find truth along the way is determined by the way we perceive reality. And that's back to, you know, like neuroscientific evidence. Like, if we, you have a different sensory input spectrum to me, like you process it differently based on your experiences, etc. So you come to very different conclusions oftentimes than me. And that is great. I think that is what our society
needs.
It's called
a pluralistic society, yeah. which sometimes people forget pluralism can be healthy in our society.
It is healthy. I think it's totally needed. And we're getting more and more pluralistic. That's actually, speaking of optimism, right? That is something that I'm excited about. Now we have to find a framework from a political perspective to make sure that doesn't divide us, but it actually makes us, you know, conceptualize that and make sure we can engage towards a future that is inhabitable for our children.
So speaking of optimism, I started the American Optimist to push back against this wave of cynicism and pessimism in the United States. And from your perspective in Europe, what would you say to Americans who don't believe the future is brighter than the past? Do you share the same concerns? And is there this pessimism in Europe as well? Is this a big challenge right now?
It's interesting you ask that. I personally always perceived the U.S. to be super optimistic, you know? And that's maybe because I've always... You know, my grandfather on the paternal side was American. I went to boarding school in the U.S. And I always, coming to the U.S., I was like, wow, it's like amazing how people just believe in a better future.
Well, your friends like me here are very optimistic.
Yeah, exactly. And so maybe I have like a bias. Maybe I'm not seeing a lot of the pessimism that you are encountering.
Your friends are venture capitalists here who are.
Yeah, but
I
have not only been like, I'm friends with a lot of artists. I'm friends with you know, in school, I have friends from boarding school when I went to U.S. boarding school. So I have like, I would say like one of the strong suits I probably have is that
You partner with optimists. You have them around you.
I have them around. But like, just going back to that point, I think I've always interacted with very different areas of society, right? Like,
are the artists optimistic, really, that you know here? It's because that would be cool, because I don't know too many. Most artists tend to be seen right now as more nihilist, more cynical.
It depends. You have everything on the spectrum. Yeah. You know what I mean? But I think like you also are, I'm personally drawn to people that are optimistic. I think the best in us are optimists with experience. Yes. The worst are cynicists when it comes to creation, because if you're cynical, like there's no, you know, you just end up being nihilistic, right? It's important to understand that. I love reading it. I think it's interesting, but it's not going to be something that you should expose yourself with too much, or you should personally assume. You have to take a side. Like, you cannot be cynic, I think.
Do you see America and Europe solving some of these problems you were describing with democracy? Or is this something we can get through in a positive way?
To be honest, right now, like, my sense is that we have to invest a lot more work to make that happen. Right? I think we have to make sure we come back to like a beneficial conversational ground again, because what we're currently seeing is just basically postures, right? It's gotten to this level of abstraction, and that is abstracted away from reality.
It's not a healthy level. We got to find a way to make it healthier.
Exactly.
Well, so what areas of innovation are you most excited about the next 10, 20 years? Like, what emerging technologies can positively influence our society and our lives?
Oh my God, there's so many. I think it's very interesting, Joe. I think there's so many overlapping technologies. I think AI is probably one of them, right? And think we haven't even reached the full potential of where that application can go. So I think that's something where we spend a lot of time, especially in Europe, looking at, you know, AI applied to vertical sectors such as manufacturing.
So AI can make all these things cheaper. I have all these friends around social media who are, they believe they're technological determinists. So they think like there's like a metaverse and AI is going to make it really interesting, but they're kind of dystopian technological determinists. Like, they seem to think we're all going to live in a metaverse and it's all going to be totally different. And there's always problems that can emerge based on that. Like, is that right? Is there like this cynical future? Or what should the world look like in 2050 if we have like the technologies?
To be honest, I don't know. I find that whole discussion fascinating, right? I think it's really fascinating. I think also that's the reason why sci-fi novels exist, right? And I think it's great that we have people in the valley. Isn't that cool? I think it's just cool that people just kind of flesh that out and make us see that as a potential, right? I think 5 years ago when we had our first conference and that you joined, the big discussion was, oh my God, are robots going to steal our jobs? You know, like, what's going to happen? Like, we're going to all these autonomous cars, like everybody's going to go bankrupt.
Oh yeah, we'll be fine with all that.
Exactly. And now we basically say, we hope the robots will come, you know, like five years down the line, we need more robots because we just don't have the manual labor to get the job done.
In the working class.
Exactly. And I think there's never been like, GDP growth without population growth.
So far, this stuff's all working to help.
Exactly, so far it's working to help. And then I think like on the, it's great to have that as inspiration. Probably part of that will manifest, right? But I still believe that what we're doing now, talking to one another, seeing you finally again after COVID, is great. You know, it's just something that I don't think is gonna go away. It's gonna go away too soon. And we see that I think with remote work, and I think we have invested heavily and doubled down on the industry because it's an interesting sector to invest in. I think a lot of it's here to stay. But I think looking at Hopin as one example of virtual conferencing that has just kind of not grown as fast since people are able to meet in person again, because ultimately that's where human connection happens and where, you know, you can unleash a whole lot more energy and creativity and like actual deeper thought and exchange than just through virtual interfaces.
That's a great note to close on. Human connection and in person is good. So we'll have to have more big conferences at the castle. It's more fun than virtual.
Well, I hope you come back soon.
Thanks, Jeanette, for joining.
Thank you.